It's a kind of paradoxical comfort, I think, for modern people, because we feel like we're going to be more comfortable belonging to ourselves because we can trust ourselves, we can protect ourselves. But the idea is that actually God knows better than us.
This season, you and I have been asking, what does it mean to be human? Over the past 10 episodes, we've explored how far-reaching that question really is, and not just in abstract, philosophical terms. What it means to be human ultimately impacts your daily life, how you form friendships, use technology, think about your body and health, and approach the time you have. And it makes sense that what it means to be human can stretch from philosophy to application, because ultimately it informs a personal question, one that you and I are constantly asking ourselves. Who am I? Approaching these questions of what does it mean to be human and who am I can be overwhelming. What if your answer isn't right? Do you even know if there is a right answer? Can you change your mind? And is there a point when you have to have it all figured out? In our final episode of the season, we address that anxiety, that burden. Perhaps having to figure it all out is too much pressure. What if you don't have to come up with all the answers? Today, you and I are going beyond the forum with Dr. Alan Noble. He's an English professor and author, and we talk about the struggle that comes with making sense of what it means to be human. His most recent book is entitled, You Are Not Your Own, Belonging to God in an Inhuman World. This book covers a lot of ground, and it's fantastic. We're only going to get a taste of Alan's writing for this interview, so I encourage you to order a copy for yourself. A link to order is in the podcast description. This is the Veritas Forum podcast, a place for generous dialogue about the ideas that shape our lives. This season, we're asking, what does it mean to be human? I'm your host, Carly Riegel, and I'm the podcast producer for the Veritas Forum, a Christian nonprofit that hosts conversations that matter across different worldviews. Alan, thank you so much for joining us. It's really a pleasure to have you on our podcast today. I really enjoyed You Are Not Your Own, and I'm really looking forward to discussing it with you.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. So the main title of your book, You Are Not Your Own, is obviously that, but your subtitle mentions the fact that we are, or at least you claim, that we're living in an inhuman world. So without giving us implications of what living in an inhuman world is, could you just describe what you mean by that? What's the water that we're swimming in here?
It's dirty water. That's the water we're swimming in. Yeah. So the way I like to explain this is through this concept of zoochosis, because I think it kind of captures what it feels like. And I got my PhD at Baylor. And they have these fantastic bears. Only one of them is alive right now, but Lady and Joy are these two Baylor bears, maybe brown, maybe black bears. I don't really know. I'm not a bear expert. I teach literature, not bears. In any case, they had these bears in a bear habitat on campus. And I would take my daughter, who is, you know, a baby and then an infant and a toddler, while we were there to go see these bears that were fascinating. And they lived in this habitat that, frankly, was better than the graduate apartment that I was living in at the time. Yet every time I went there with my daughter, the bears were doing the same thing. They would be pacing in circles. And there was a circle in the grass where they would pace, and it was worn down to the dirt. And you could tell, like, you don't have to be a bear expert to tell, like, these bears are unwell. These bears are sick. This is not what a healthy bear does. A healthy bear does not pace in circles all day long. That's a sign of some kind of sickness. And one way of describing that sickness is called zoochosis, a psychosis for animals in captivity. And there are a couple of interesting things about this. I'm not going to argue that our society is inhuman because we're living in a zoo. And we're not captive zoo animals. It's not exactly like that. But there are some similarities. So for example, all societies, all cultures are intentionally designed with a vision of what it means to be human. We have certain ideas about the purpose of human life, and that's how we shape our laws and our aesthetics and our ideas of justice and our values, our language, our clothing, everything, roads, buildings. And so it's always designed intentionally, and our society is designed intentionally. But I think that like the bear is pacing, there's a lot of evidence that we're pacing in circles. One of them that I would give would be the rise in mental health crises. I teach at a college, and I've taught at several colleges, and colleges are sort of ground zero for this growing mental health crisis. There are a lot of people, a lot of young people who are suffering, and that number seems to be increasing. So one recent survey that I cite in my book says that nearly 43% of undergraduates felt so depressed that it was difficult to function in the past year. And 64% said they felt overwhelming anxiety. That's a lot of percents. To me, that's a sign of pacing. Older people aren't doing a whole lot better, frankly. There's a couple of signs of these. One is the declining life expectancy in the United States. I don't remember the exact date that this started, but several years ago, we actually started living fewer years instead of more years. And that's remarkable, because in industrialized countries, the life expectancy really just goes one direction. It just goes up. People just live longer. And even before the COVID crisis, life expectancy started declining. And the three main reasons, according to these economists who wrote this book called Deaths of Despair, the three main reasons were suicides, drug overdoses, and alcoholism. So another example is right now, a recent survey found that between 1990 and 2021, the percentage of men who have no, as in zero, close friends went from 3% in 1990, which is not so bad. 3% of men have no close friends, to 15%. So that's a 5 times increase, according to math, which I also don't teach, but I know math. So there are all these things in society, all this evidence that we're unwell, that there's a sickness. And I think it's because the way society is structured, it assumes something about our human nature that's not true. And because of that, we're constantly rubbing against it. We're constantly in friction with the society.
Yeah. These are really powerful statistics that you just shared. Something that you kind of touched on is this increase in anxiety and depression among college students. And at the Veritas Forum, we work with college students. We work on college campuses. And I think many of our listeners would relate and identify with that. And I guess I'm curious if you could speak a little bit more to why is it that people are feeling more anxious and more depressed on college campuses specifically? Do you have any insight as a college professor yourself?
So this is just utter speculation, right? Because it's a really great question. And from my reading, it doesn't seem like there's a clear answer, right? So there are a couple of possibilities. One possibility is that we're just doing a whole lot better at diagnosing, and we're doing a lot better at reducing stigma. And so now just more people are getting the help that they need. I think that's part of it. But I also think in my reading, it seems like that doesn't explain all of it, that there are still too many cases, still too much of an increase to be explained by diagnoses and declining stigma. But my sense of things is that college students are under tremendous pressure, and they're under cross pressures that are unbearable, and they don't really have the resources to cope with those pressures. So, for example, there's tremendous pressure, and hopefully we'll get into this, to create, define, craft, promote, brand, and identity. That can be a full-time job in itself, to manage your identity. And then there's the task of finding something that not only pays your bills, but is meaningful, right? So this is a big thing, is that young people recognize that they need to have jobs that are meaningful. But we live in a hyper-competitive society as well. And that means those jobs are difficult to get. And so there's a lot of anxiety about trying to find a job that you can get. There's also a lot of different options available to young people. And so in my experience, there's a big feeling that I might make the wrong choice. And if your existential validation, if your sense of fullness, of satisfaction, of meaning and of purpose is dependent upon finding the one right career, and that's how it feels to a lot of young people, to a lot of older people too, then everything counts on that, right? Like you can't blow it. And that can create a lot of anxiety. And then, of course, once you add like the cost of college and the fact that I think a lot of young people don't have mentorship, like they don't have anyone older who they can rely on to give them counsel and advice, you know, that means that they're struggling through these things alone.
Yeah. I think I resonate with that really deeply. I went to Cornell for undergrad and graduated a couple of years ago. And I feel like that incredible pressure and anxiety and feeling like this choice paralysis. And I want to read you this quote that talks about this general notion of freedom, but maybe not so much freedom in the way that our world is constructed. So this is from Taylor Swift. And this is actually directly from her commencement speech to NYU's class of 2022. So let me read this quote and then I'll ask you some questions. So, I know it can be really overwhelming figuring out who to be and when, who you are now and how to act in order to get where you want to go. I have some good news. It's totally up to you. I also have some terrifying news. It's totally up to you.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that she said that after my book came out. Yeah, if it was before, I'd have it in the book.
So I think it's interesting that Taylor Swift distinguishes that there is both good news and bad news to this freedom of self-expression and freedom of like self-determination and self-actualization. And I feel like there actually is good news about this. As a woman, I'm able to like go to college and able to have a variety of jobs that I wasn't able to have previously. And I guess I was just curious if you could talk to what is good about this burden or responsibility to self-actualize.
So I don't know that there's anything good about the burden to self-actualize. So, but I will say to what you were referring to is having the freedom, the liberty to choose jobs and to choose career paths. And that can be a path to self-actualization. And so the distinction I want to make is that having options doesn't necessarily reflect on your sense of identity and being in the world, your significance, your purpose. It can just be something that you do. And it's a good thing. I like to say that it's a good thing that we don't live 300 years ago when, I'm guessing at this, but maybe probably 90% of the population of the world were farmers of some kind. It's a good thing for you guys because I would be a terrible farmer. Like, I'm just not. It's good that we have options, that I can choose to go into something that I'm actually skilled at. So the modern liberal state that allows us to have these freedoms, that's a good thing that we have those freedoms. But what I think Swift is describing is something more than just choosing an occupation. And that's what I think, you know, what you're referring to is self-actualization. Like it goes deep to your very existence, the significance of your existence. And that's a whole nother thing.
Yeah. I think it's telling that she uses the word terrifying. I have some terrifying news. It's totally up to you. Like, I think there is some sense in the general culture as we're living in this inhuman world, even if, you know, you're listening, and you're like, I don't really think that the world is inhuman. You do have this sense that it is terrifying, the capacity we have to self-actualize. Now we can get to the implications of this inhuman world we're living in. What do you think is terrifying?
So my thesis is that our society is built on the assumption that human beings, fundamentally, each of us are our own and we belong to ourselves. That to be a human means that you belong only and ever to yourself. Now, you can choose to temporarily belong to others in some limited ways, but fundamentally, we are our own. And that's the human state. And so I think we built a society based on that idea. And if that's true, then Swift is right. Because that means that everything significant is dependent upon you. And that's the terrifying thing. It's not just that you have lots of good job opportunities and career choices. That's just a positive thing. And then you can just choose one good one. And because your identity and your existence doesn't depend on it, you choose a good one and then that's it. But if your very selfhood, your very identity, your being in the world is really dependent upon what you create, it's on one hand incredibly liberating because nobody else can define you. Nobody else can determine your purpose, your meaning, your significance, your values. You're utterly free. But it's also terrifying because you have to bear all of those burdens. It's not an option. And it's interesting because I think a lot of existentialist literature recognizes this dual nature, the thrill of this radical freedom, and then the fear, the terror that Swift's talking about. Because when you have that freedom, you are actually trapped by it. It's not actually a freedom in a sense. It's a burden, an obligation that you have to follow through with. You don't have a choice but to self-actualize, or you could live as a kind of zombie, as a kind of fake human, an inauthentic life, they would say. But you have to have the courage to create your own identity. And I think we live in a society that constantly is reminding us, you have the burden to create your own identity. You have the burden to create your purpose, to choose your purpose. Make sure you get it right because you've only got one shot at this.
Yeah. I feel like when we're faced with that pressure or anxiety of creating our own identity, I love the distinction that you make there. It's not that women being able to have a job outside of the home is bad.
Right.
It's the fact that there is so much pressure on what that role, what that job means, and how it relates to who you are as an individual. I think one of the things that really struck me when I was reading your book was this conversation surrounding technique. I think it was very helpful. I really would love to hear your words on what technique is, how it relates to this burden of identity, and what the right choice is. Would love to hear from you.
Yeah, so I'm getting this idea of technique from a French sociologist from the mid-century called Jacques Ellul, and I judge scholars based on the sounds of their names. If they have a good name, he's one of the best.
Yeah.
He's a brilliant man. Jacques Ellul. So he comes up with this, The Technological Society is his book, and that where he really works with this idea, and then he continues to work with it throughout his career. But by it, he means rational methods of maximizing efficiency in really every sphere of human activity. And when you stop to think about it, if you start paying attention, where are we trying to maximize efficiency? It's easier to answer the question, where are we not trying to maximize efficiency? Because it's really everywhere. So technique, I think, is one of the few values that we can agree on as a society when we're each our own. We might not be able to agree on other forms of morality, you know, sexual ethics, for example, but we can all agree, or virtually all agree, that being more efficient is a good thing. So if I scroll through my social media, I'll get ads for a service that I find disturbing that will write blog posts for me or papers for me. Right? I just type in a few things and it will fill out the rest. Okay? So that's maximizing efficiency. That's technique. And one of the effects of technique is that it creates a moral burden on you. Students will feel this acutely. The more things that are advertised to them as systems for maximizing their studying habits or their time or having the best possible experience while on college, every one of those techniques lands like a boulder on their shoulders, because the implication is, if I don't do this, then I'm somehow inadequate. I'm not living the full maximal life that I can live. At the same time, it's impossible to do all these right things for a number of reasons. One is that these techniques are constantly evolving and people can't agree on them. The other reason is that there are so many areas of your life that you could maximize efficiently that you can't get around to any of them. And so you feel overwhelmed. Elul says it's not that efficiency is bad. He's not saying, hey, you should be as inefficient as possible. No, his point is that in technique, other values get squashed. Other values get not even secondary rankings. They just sort of disappear. And what happens is efficiency becomes the most important thing. We care about being efficient. We no longer care about the environment or working conditions. That writing program that I gave as an example, that service that I have advertised to me, which will write blog posts for me. My newsletters are not written by this service. And the reason they're not written by this service is that I value something more than efficiency, right? Like I value my ideas and the good of my reader over efficiency. So could I publish more, a lot more, if I use this service? Yes, I could. But what that service is saying is that your ideas, your originality, your creativity is not as important. So that's what technique is. That's what it does to us. It creates this intense moral pressure to perform, to be ideal. And it squashes other values, more, I would say, human values like beauty, goodness, truth.
Yeah. Something that I think really struck me in this, oh, when I have a problem, I Google it. I figure out what Wirecutter has to say about what thing I need to buy or read this listicle and try these things. It seems to be something that diminishes our relationality. We're immediately turning to Google. And I guess this kind of relates to your idea in your book. You talk about like conditionality in our relationships with each other. And like this idea that, well, I will be friends with someone until they don't meet my needs.
That's right. Yeah. Another great scholar, Zygmunt Bauman, Polish, I believe, Zygmunt Bauman. He's great because he's got a great name. He wrote this book called Liquid Modernity. And that's where I get that idea of until furtherness. He says something like, you know, all relationships in a liquid society, a society that's not static, that's constantly shifting under our feet. A society like that, which is the society I'm trying to describe, relationships become relationships until further notice, right? And so, you know, I'm married until I find somebody better, or until things get difficult, or we're friends until you offend me. Yeah, and that's no way to live. It goes back to that tension that Swift described. Having loose bonds gives us more freedom to choose people to whom we want to belong. And that feels liberating. Like I'm not tied down to my family or to my friends. I can belong to whomever I want, whenever I want, wherever I want. But it leaves us depleted. It leaves us diminished. And it leaves us lonely. Again, I would point back to those statistics. From 3% to 15% of men have no close friends. Well, why is that? Well, maybe this is part of the answer, that we're so disconnected from each other. And I suppose you're right that our reliance on technology does mean that we're not relying on craftsmen, on friends, on people in our community to fix problems that we have. And it's nice that I can try to fix my own dishwasher, which I won't try to do because it would be, I also don't teach dishwasher repair, but we're also missing something in depending upon other people, you know, whom we could build relationships with.
Well, I think we've painted a pretty bleak picture here. Rise in depression and anxiety, the self-medication that you talk about in your book that we didn't even get to in this interview. It just seems kind of like an overwhelming problem. Maybe some people who are listening to this are realizing things about their own life and realizing things about their relationships and their relationship to place, relationship to people, relationship to the techniques and technology that they use. So I guess, what do we do? What do we do about this?
Yeah, so I think the first thing I would respond with is that we need an alternative. If belonging to ourselves is the source of so much of this, and I think it is, then we need to figure out an alternative form of belonging. And I think the alternative is that we are not our own, but belong to God. So for example, I've touched on repeatedly this burden that we have to create and sustain and promote and project an identity, which is an overwhelming burden. And, you know, the reality is, if Swift is right and we have this radical freedom to create our own identity, then we have the burden to express that identity, to get it out into the world, to make it known to everyone, and to be constantly promoting it. The way I like to describe it is, imagine there's this massive warehouse, and in the warehouse, everyone is shouting their own name. And the goal is to get somebody to hear them, to get just one person to hear them. But because everybody is shouting their own name, nobody is listening. How could you ever know if you are known? And that's kind of what social media feels like. The same thing is true with purpose. You know, we talked about this burden to find your purpose in life through a career. And I think it's true. If you are your own and you belong to yourself and you have this radical freedom that Swift described, then you had better find the one career that's going to give your life purpose, meaning, and value. On the question of identity, identity is very interesting because on the one hand, we have this tension between we want to be able to say, nobody can define me. This is assuming that we are our own and belong to ourselves. But also, identity necessarily requires a witness. Somebody's got to be outside of me to look at me and say, oh, you're Alan. And I see your identity and I affirm your identity. And that creates this unbearable tension where we're pretending that we're self-reliant. And on the other hand, we're totally reliant on other people for affirmation. But if we belong to God, then our identity is grounded in His perfect gaze, right? Because He sees us perfectly, without confusion, without deception, without any doubt or any hiding of our sins or our, you know, He knows us better than we know ourselves. And He sees us and He loves us. And so that, I think, that's a way that these things can be radically shifted. Now, that said, when you come to understand that we belong to God, it changes things in profound ways. But society is still going to pressure you. Society is still going to say, I'm sorry, you got to find your purpose in your career. And society is still going to say, I'm sorry, you have to have a brand identity and you've got to be promoting it. And so we're still going to feel these pressures, but we have a way of fighting back, of resisting, if we know that our existence is grounded in God.
Yeah. I think this idea of belonging to God, I mean, as a Christian, it seems, you know, like kind of like a logical thought progression. But for people who are listening to this, who maybe they aren't a Christian, but they're curious about Christianity, or maybe they are a Christian, but they're like, what does that mean? Can you give a little bit of a, like, how did we get to that being the next step? You know, like, is there a historical basis for this, why belonging to God is important?
Right. So, you know, where I'm getting this, I mean, I'm getting this from 1 Corinthians. So, you know, the Bible, this is an idea in the Bible. It's grounded in this idea that you're not your own, but you were bought with a price. And so there's a sense in which God has stewardship over us, that He cares for us. And the Heidelberg Catechism is where I sort of draw this from. It's from the 15th century, this text that is used to just describe, that's what a catechism is, just to describe what the Christian faith is. And that's the first question that they ask in the catechism is, what is your only comfort in life and death? Which is a fascinating question because it's such an existentialist question. And their answer is that we are not our own but belong to God, which is profound. Because it suggests that there is a comfort, and it's a kind of paradoxical comfort, I think, for modern people, because we feel like we're going to be more comfortable belonging to ourselves because we can trust ourselves, we can protect ourselves. But the idea is that actually God knows better than us, and that in belonging to Him and identifying, finding our being, our existence, our life, when we live, move, and have our being in God, then we're grounded. There's a great comfort there that we don't get when we're having to be self-sufficient.
Mm. Yeah. You use the word steward in that response. And I think that was something that really stood out to me when in your book, when you were talking about the implications of belonging to God. I think sometimes, especially since we're in such a individualistic culture, this idea of belonging kind of brings up these notions of ownership and like being put into a box and, you know, being constrained. But could you talk a little bit about why belonging to God is maybe more related to stewardship than it is to ownership, or what the implications of it are?
Yeah, so I'm not afraid of saying ownership, but we have to change our perception because of who God is. So the first thing that comes to mind is thinking about God as the Good Shepherd, right? So somebody who's guiding us, who's caring for us, who's protecting us. That's an image of God's relationship to us. The other thing I would say is this: belonging to anyone else but God in this world means that we are going to be taken advantage of at one point or another. Abuse often happens, or maybe always happens. I suspect that it always happens when somebody takes advantage of a form of belonging. And so, and that's because everybody else in this world at some point is going to put their good above yours. So for example, my children belong to me in a sense, and I belong to my children in a sense. But when I'm tired, I often put my own good before their good. I often choose to say, I'm too tired. I'm not going to play with you, or something like this, right? When I'm in a bad mood, instead of being humble and recognizing that I should change my mood, I choose to put my good before their good. So there are conflicting goods. But God is the only being for whom it's not only possible, but true that He can desire our good and His good without conflict. Mm. And that is the difference maker, I think. So when we talk about ownership, the scary thing is we think about abuse. We think about someone taking advantage of us. And I guess what I would respond with is to say, and I think this is the reason why I use stewardship, because it sounds more like what it's describing here. But what I would say is that God doesn't take advantage of us. He's always working our good in His good. That's the difference in literally every other relationship we'll ever have.
Wow. I really hope that people who are listening to this are feeling some curiosity about what belonging to God could really look like. I feel like even many people who are Christians today, this is a really challenging topic. And I feel like you really laid a good foundation and hopefully piqued some curiosity. So for those who are listening, just to kind of wrap up, for those who are listening and are curious about what would it look like to act on this or to realize this belonging to God, what would you recommend? What would you say is a good next step?
Yeah. So, I mean, other than read my book, which kind of goes into detail about what I think this looks like, I think it's a slow process. I think it's a slow process of internalizing truths that are alien to us in the contemporary world. And I think you need to do that in community. I think it's hard to do that by yourself. I think it's important to find community of people who recognize that belonging to yourself is a form of death. It's a form of suffocation. It's an unbearable burden. And when you do that, you can start building each other up and encouraging each other. So for example, we've talked a lot about careers. Well, what if we had communities where people aren't pressuring young people to find the one right career and to know what that career is as soon as possible and to be working with everything they have to get that and secure that and become this, you know, perfect person or ideal person or productive member of society in a very specific way. That's, I think, part of what this looks like. But it also looks like on the micro level, just in your own head, it looks like talking back to the voices in society. Talking back. It looks like seeing when technique is taking over and suppressing more important values and labeling that and denying it. It looks like recognizing when society is telling you, you have to become someone, you have to have a definable identity that is expressed out in the world, and being able to say to that, no, I don't. My identity is grounded in God. And then choosing not to. One of Jacques Ellul's ideas is that we must choose not to do all that we can do. So in a society that's telling you, you have to do everything, actively choosing not to is a form of resistance.
That's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. Well, thank you so much, Alan. It was great to have you on. And everybody, read You Are Not Your Own. The link's in the podcast description.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode. I hope this interview inspires future thought and reflection on our season-long question of what it means to be human, and even help you personally to answer, who am I? Before we wrap up this episode, I want to share one last thing with you, something that I found particularly helpful when faced with the problems of this inhuman world. Near the end of Alan's book, he shares a few questions to help prompt reflection on what it means to be human. As we end this Veritas Forum podcast season, I invite you to investigate these questions, to wonder about what belonging to God could mean for your life. First question, where do you elevate efficiency, productivity, or profit over beauty, goodness, or truth? Second question, in your daily conversations and actions, how do you compete for attention and significance? Third question, how does your job or business encourage people to believe that they are their own? Final question, how does your presence in your community contribute to or distract from the humanity of your neighbors? Here at Veritas, we believe that questions are best asked with friends. So get together a couple of people and discuss together. Let us know what you discussed too. You can shoot me an email at podcast@veritas.org. We'll be taking a short break before the start of our 12th season in February 2023, when we'll tackle questions of meaning and purpose. In the meantime, we'll have two new Beyond the Forum interview episodes for you to enjoy. Go ahead and subscribe to the Veritas Forum podcast so you don't miss a single episode. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Veritas Forum podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, take a second to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. We love hearing from you. Our production is led by me, Carly Regal, and the team at Resonate Recordings. Thanks to Bethany Jenkins and Sabrina Seward for providing content editing for this episode, and to Heather Beloga for coordinating all of our audio editing needs. Thank you to our guest for this episode, Dr. Alan Noble. Alan, thank you for joining us and for sharing such powerful statistics and stories. If you're intrigued by our interview today, please be sure to order a copy of You Are Not Your Own using the link in the description below. We only covered a portion of what Alan discusses in his book. There's so much more that he goes into that we couldn't cover in a short interview. Thanks also to our incredible partners who help support Veritas and make sure these conversations are possible. And a final thanks goes to you, the listener. Be sure to mark your calendars for season 12. Our first episode drops in February 2023.